be for people who are either local to the area of New York City, where it is located, or they can be people connected by IRLP, Internet. You're all welcome to join the Internet, join the technical net, by which we ask each other questions and usually get answers. The technical net, its main purpose in life is to transfer information about how ham radio and wireless electronics in particular, how it all works. We plan each Sunday night for the last 27 years and help each other understand this stuff. You don't get perfect answers all the time, but the price is right. I'm K2 Romeo India, and along with K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, his name is Mel. We try to act as the interlocutors to this gathering, this crazy group of people who want to understand how wireless works. A person signs into the technical net by giving your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. After 27 years, you need not sign in to let us know you're there. By now, we sort of assume that after 27 years, this particular repeater covers pretty much of the metropolitan New York area, a good fraction of Long Island, a good fraction of northern New Jersey, a good fraction of western Connecticut, and a fraction of southern New York State. So with that kind of coverage, we've got people who are listening. Do we have any check-ins? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW.
W-H-O-I-Y.
No.
Yes. Net tonight at 8 o'clock. Net tonight at 8 o'clock.
Now that's the advertisement for this particular net. Joe recognized. Anyone else?
W-S-2-N. Just listening right now, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. Paul is our space expert. Hopefully he'll tell us what's going on, whether or not they've discovered water yet on the moon, among other NASA events. And I bet you when we really get rolling, Paul will have a question, too. So far we got Joe and Paul. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
Good evening, Dick. F2EO. No questions at this time.
Very fine, Rich, but we guarantee you'll have a question a little later. Who else would like to check in? Give me your call letters and name now.
Good evening, K2KEY.
I wonder who he is. That's Mel. The man from Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn. Okay, anyone else would like to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay, we got a slightly slow beginning. I don't know if this is one of the nights when the World Series is on. Maybe it is. Joe, you're the front on the runway. And we got lots of time. Take your time. What would you like to talk about? And I know one of the last things we talked about with you was methods of improving the accuracy of a direction finding system or a angle of arrival system. Wonder how that's how that particular project is going. W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W.
Well, I had a completely different question. It depends on whether you open the email I sent you, the link I sent you about 4, 5, 6 days ago. Did you do that?
Okay, give me a hint. What was the subject matter of the email? And I'll go look for it right now.
It had to do with a defense system on a tank using something like plasma energy to defend. Go look for that.
My goodness. You would think I would certainly recognize something like that if you sent it by my normal email system, which I'm looking at right now. I'm starting off, you said a week and a half ago. Okay.
1 week. Less than 1 week.
Okay, less than 1 week. So far, I'm not seeing it in my normal email. I'm going to take a look at the things that got automatically discarded and see if it's there. Sorry to say, I'm not seeing it, Joe. When I look for the sender logo, will it start off with the word Joe?
Probably. Probably said that my email address says has my call letters on it.
Okay, I'm still continuing to look under that method. I'm looking for everything now that begins with Joe.
Well, instead of wasting a lot of time, if you don't have it, I can turn on my computer and resend it to you. But just like hold my place, so to speak, and let me pick it up, and I guess I'll pick it up later on. But it was a very interesting type of thing, something that's, I guess you have to watch the video that the link is actually a link to. Once you watch the video for a moment, so you'll know what I'm talking about. It's, I found it rather fascinating, this type of subject. Apparently, it's been out for a short amount of time, but I don't know much about it. I thought maybe you did.
I just found it. Electromagnetic Reactive Armor from Joe, W2LYY. And I guess this is a YouTube thing to look at. Now, there is a electromagnetic defensive system that the government has developed, which creates a very strong heating effect on human beings. It works at 94 gigahertz. It's got a phased array to it, and a person standing in front of this thing 1,000 yards away, a person standing in front of this thing 1,000 yards away feels an extremely uncomfortable amount of heat, which is pulsating in a particular way that excites his alarm system. Is similar, the system you're discussing, somewhat similar to that one, Joe? Go ahead.
Has nothing to do with that whatsoever. It's not using heat radiation as a source of defense. It's using a capacitive discharge system to basically vaporize a weapon as it's fired into the side of a tank. And it's just the theory of what this thing is doing. I found it rather fascinating. But why don't you take a moment and just watch the link and connect to it. You'll see what I'm talking
about. Yeah, I'm watching the link right now, and I see a tank coming toward, I guess, what's going to be the target, or where somebody's about to shoot at the tank. Looks like the whole display takes 57 seconds. It's 20 seconds into it. Stand by while I watch this and try to come up with an opinion. Okay, I've seen the video, and I really don't have enough information as to what it is and how it works. So, from your watching of the video, Joe, what is your impression as to what it is and how it works? Go ahead.
I really don't know how it works. It sounds like what they're doing is, from what the description says, they're discharging a tremendous amount of energy across these plates on the side of the tank when this gets hit by a rocket-propelled grenade. And the idea, I guess, is this thing is vaporizing the rocket-propelled grenade's head before it can penetrate the armor of the tank. And I just thought it'd be interesting to talk about something like that, because it probably has to take a tremendous amount of energy and joules to be able to do something like that. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, this thing could be an EMP generator, electromagnetic pulse generator. There have been systems that have been experimented on which will disable the ignition system and the other electronics on an automobile when you drive over a coil that is generating an intense EMP. If you have charged capacitors, and let me backtrack, the fancy thing about a ideal capacitor is that you cannot instantaneously change the voltage on a capacitor. If you take a whole lot of farads of charged capacitor, put them across a low inductance coil, you can get many thousands of amperes of current to flow through the coil caused by the charge on the capacitors, maybe even 100,000 amperes. That, by the way, is approximately what happens with a really strong lightning bolt. A really strong lightning bolt can be numbers like 100,000 amperes and above. Only takes a couple of microseconds of doing that. And that extremely strong changing magnetic field in the vicinity of that high current coil will create in every conductor nearby, every piece of wire and transistor and whatever, will pick up a certain number of volts per inch or volts per centimeter. And if you exceed some number of volts per centimeter, the electronics is damaged, destroyed, disrupted, disabled, all the D words. So, an extremely strong electromagnetic pulse will damage electronics. The warhead on this missile that was aiming toward the tank probably had some electronics involved. There's a proximity fuse, possibly, that knows when it's close to the tank, knows when it should explode. And if you can damage that electronics before it gets a chance to do its thing, that is a potential protection mechanism. So, that's my first guess as to what it could be, an EMP generator. Does that sound close to what you know so far, Joe? From HULYY, HULYW in the TechNet. I'll leave a little bit of delay in case anyone wants to join us from outside the area.
There you go, that's a big enough gap. That didn't seem like this video that I viewed, the same thing you viewed, it didn't seem like that's what this thing was doing. It wasn't generating electromagnetic field, it was generating some sort of discharge as the projectile penetrated one of the plates. If you watch the entire video from start to finish, you'll see one plate as it's destroyed, looks like it's got a layer, like there's a layer underneath it, like there's two plates. And as it looks like as the projectile penetrates the first plate, the energy is discharged between the plates, and it looks like it just completely vaporizes the head of this weapon and prevents it from going into the tank. That's like what I said before. I just thought the theory of something like that is pretty neat because it's got to be a lot of energy that you're dissipating over, you know, in a matter of like milliseconds or microseconds.
And maybe even nanoseconds. If you have an ideal enough capacity, with enough farads of capacitance, a low enough internal resistance in the order of milliohms or microohms, all of which is doable, the amount of stored energy is such that it is capable of issuing a spike of current in the many thousands of amperes and maybe even 100,000 amperes. Now, if a penetrating missile, if it is made out of a depleted or some other kind of massive material which ordinarily has significant penetration capability and starting to penetrate the armor on the outside of the tank, could you rapidly enough disrupt that massive material? I'm having trouble with this one, as you can tell, because the way some of these penetration weapons work is that you've got a very high density object like depleted uranium moving at high velocity as a charge. So as you penetrate the outer armor of the tank, can you change the shape of the charge? I doubt it. Can you melt the material fast enough? I don't think that would do any good because the mass of the material is still there. So the penetration capability is high density material, the correct shape, moving fast, penetrating the layers of armor. And can an electromagnetic pulse or an electrostatic discharge of high current damage that penetration capability fast enough to stop it from penetrating the rest of the tank? Can it vaporize that material fast enough? I'm having trouble with this one because that penetration time is like a microsecond. And if you're trying to heat up and vaporize massive materials and you've got a microsecond to do it with, wow. It sounds like we've got an irresistible force and an immovable object here. Not easy to calculate. Very similar to what happens with other impulse characteristics. When two steel balls come together, you know how much energy each steel ball has. You know the velocity they've got. So assuming they don't shatter each other, after the bounce you can, with high precision, predict what direction they will be traveling. But the actual instant of impact is a number of pounds that is essentially beyond calculation. But you don't always have to calculate that in an impulse situation. But this one's bothering me. How did you find this video, Joe? Is this the first time you've seen it? Are there other websites giving a little bit more data about this particular protective weapon? I presume this is an experimental lab curiosity at this time that hasn't yet been deployed. These are some of my guesses. And correct some of my guesses, Joe. From HULYY, HULYW in the TechNet.
And maybe I can shed some light, K2KEY.
Well, basically, things on YouTube are pretty simple. You go on there looking for one thing, and you can spend 2 hours later you're looking at something else because it's always, it just leads you from one link to another, and everything looks fascinating to look at. And I just happened to be like, there were four or five different layers deep when I was originally looking for something else. Another similar subject, but not that subject. I wouldn't look for that particularly. That's how I happened to find it. I would have never thought of looking for something like that on there. But I agree with you. I know they use uranium, depleted uranium, for the rounds that are in, like the A-10, for example, which, you know, do a pretty good job of penetrating very thick armor on a tank. That's why they use it, because it becomes a very cool tank color that way. How you would melt something like that or destroy something like that in a matter of microseconds or so is really beyond me. That's what it looks like. this thing is actually doing. That's why I brought the thing up as a subject. It's kind of fascinating, don't you think?
Mel recognized, sure is. Something unusual is going on here, Joe. Are you coming into the western input of this machine, which is a very unusual way for you? Go ahead.
Here's another question for you. How many pounds am I hitting you with on the input? Pretty strong?
Roger, Dodger. Nice strong signal on the input. And is that the method by which you're getting into the machine? Like, into the western input today, you normally don't do it that way. Sounds like you've made some changes to your system. Go ahead.
I'm putting in about 45 to 50 watts on VHF. Does that answer your question?
You've never done that before. Does that mean that you've established some new equipment?
You're very curious, aren't you? So you're the same radio that I have on VHF. This is a Motorola MP1000 HD. It only puts out about 4 or 5 watts of power. And I went downstairs today and it dug up my mobile power amplifier, which I've had for years, which is used in the car with the Converticom. That gives me 4 watts in, 50 watts out. Now that's hooked to my monitor antenna. That is my second question, if you got a moment, because that was just something I noticed with that was very interesting, which I've never experienced before. And I've had a people tell me the same thing. They've experienced similar things like this. You got a moment for that one? Maybe you can answer quickly. Maybe it's a more complicated type of the subject.
We got very few check-ins tonight. You've got two or three questions. I'm trying to get to all of them. Let's go over to Mel, who's got some additional information on the previous subject. You got Mel, K2KEY, K2LAW in the group.
Hey, let me pause. Hold on. Just want to make sure that we, because I've gotten a number of emails that they can't get in to the net. All right, anyhow, my daughter, who's always been a Star Trekkie fan, I guess we've discussed this before, and they have some place. I guess it's a site where they get together, and every so often they talk about, you know, Star Trek and what has, you know, we used to see as, oh boy, you know, really fiction of the far future has come to pass, of course, like, such as my cell phone in my pocket, which, of course, really started out on Star Trek and other things, sort of. And every so often they throw something else in. That is the, you know, actual science, not science of the future, but science right now of the present. And she just happened to remember send me this thing, and I looked at it, and they said that the government's actively working on a system that is a deflection device. Sort of a missile is fired at a tank or one of these armored carrier, you know, these carriers, these gadgets that carry people, I forgot what they call them, armored carriers or something, that it will set up a sort of a kind of a force field around it or some kind of field so that they can deflect something. I'm just paraphrasing what I remember. She said that, but to create a force field around it, like, Scotty, put up the shield around around the ship, over.
Okay, so Julie Schneider was watching this particular program in which these things were being discussed, and I think you're saying they have, according to Julie's watching of the program, when it comes to an APC, armored personnel carrier, that they found a method of protecting. Is that sort of what you're saying, Mel? Go ahead. And by the way, give us a little bit more audio if you can. Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, because I have to reset this because on the other repeater I bang up against the edge. So, all right, I'll put this up a little bit more. Anyhow, well, I can say it's that Star Trek, you know, and they more or less, you know, make comparisons a lot of times to the what we've seen on Star Trek, and if you remember the shields up, coming around the ship and all, well, supposedly that, you know, they write up a lot of things similar to what you may see in, like, popular science, you know, those magazines, and I always fascinated, I always like to read those magazines, see what's coming up, and a lot of things, a little far-fetched, of course, you know, you see all kinds of things, and so this was another one of the features that this force field type of idea that
supposedly is being seriously taken, Dick. Over.
That doesn't surprise me. There are laser weapons, or RF weapons that, you know, bursts of high power RF and laser and whatever for doing defense and damaging other pieces of hardware. So, sounds like a good thing. The, I'm trying to remember now, what was it called? I attended a meeting, I guess now going on 10 years ago, on some of these defensive systems. The name of it will come to me in a minute. RF Impulse? No, that wasn't what it was called. because it's been so long, I've forgotten the name of the program. But there was a significant portion of the Department of Defense studying other techniques, electronic warfare techniques, other than just simply jamming the signal or sending a bullet or some other kind of projectile at the offending object. So I guess what we've got to do, Joe, is find a couple of more of those YouTubes or other sources of this information. You've given us a hint. I've also had the problem with going to YouTube, seeing a particular display, and then at the end of that display, they give you an offer of seeing about five more, or ten more. And I go through the ten, and I say, gee, there's two of them there I want to see. So I select the first one, and I see it. And then I think I'm going to go back to the second one. Well, the second one is now gone. You have to backtrack a couple of steps of your, which in theory usually gives you the same, at the end of it, gives you the same other things you can select. So everything is moving so fast that if you want to see more than one of them, the one that you grab, that's great, and the other one is going to be gone after the next movie cycle. I've run into that problem with YouTube. A lot of good stuff there, though. Back to you, Joe, for any further information on this defensive weapon system and also your power supply plus your 146.25 output capability these days. You sound good. And you're giving me quite a bit of steam. To B2RYY, K2RYW and the Tech Man.
Okay, very good. I have no more information available on this at the current time. Well, it's the simplest thing with YouTube is you find something that you like to see, save it in your favorites, and then keep on going forward and watch the other stuff because it'll save you a lot of time later on when you try to backtrack. You have to use your backspacer on the browser to go back. Sometimes you may lose it, sometimes not. But anyway, like I said, with YouTube, you start looking for something, 2 hours later you're still on YouTube because that's how the way things are on that thing. My second question, this is kind of an odd one. I wanted to notice with my R7000 hooked up to the monitor antenna is that when I rotate the antenna, I never paid much attention to this before, but when I rotate the antenna using the TV antenna, looking for stations in a particular direction, I was listening to the carrier frequency of the TV station on the R7000, which is hooked up to the monitor antenna, which is disc cone. I think it's like AH7000 is cool, so like 25 to 1300 meg monitor antenna. And I noticed that as I rotate the antenna, the signal is actually changing in level up to about 5 edge units on the monitor antenna. That's supposed to be omnidirectional. Have any explanations for something like that?
Joe, you just committed one of the sins that you've accused me of very frequently. On that particular transmission, you picked up so fast, the machine did not get a chance to reset. You timed out the 147.375 machine and probably the link. Let me drop long enough and hopefully it'll all come back. Yeah, now that you're a guy coming in on 2.5, you do the same thing the rest of us do. Now, a so-called omnidirectional antenna, if it's mounted on the top of a pole, nothing else around it, and you rotate it, without a doubt there should be no change in its pattern. Its pattern should be a donut that looks parallel to the ground. You know, the major portion of the donut is parallel to the ground, is what you would normally see. However, how did the manufacturer actually generate that so-called omnidirectional antenna? It probably has three radials coming out of it, and it's going to have a slight difference in its performance in the direction of a radial versus the direction in between the radials. That should account for a wow or flutter of a dB or two. And I think you said you're seeing 10 decibels of difference when you rotate an omni antenna. Now, from the rotator up, describe to me all the hardware that includes the omni antenna. Is that all by itself? And during the rotation process, is there anything else nearby? Is there any translation of that antenna taking place? And were you listening to a signal that was cross-polarized or co-polarized? You may have run into what's called the Condon lobe problem. I'll explain that in the next transmission. Back to you, Joe. Leave a long enough delay. Amazing that I've got to say that to you, after you've only been telling us that for 30 times. But H-U-R-Y-Y with some delay, K-2-R-Y-W.
Wait, is it being let's see, listening to a horizontally polarized signal, I believe, was on UHF, about around 584 megahertz, coming from New York, and I got a approximately 5 S-unit change as they rotated the antenna. And it was not the type of indication where I thought of what you just said, where the signal would go up and down. It actually seemed to go down and stay down for quite a while and eventually go up again. I'll describe what I have above the rotor. TV antenna, UHF, beam antenna, and then quite a ways above that, at least 10 foot higher than that, is the disc cone antenna. So it's the most topmost mount. I think it's actually probably closer to 10 feet above the rotor. The top of the rotor and the bottom of the disc cone antenna itself. So that's got some sort of spacing. And I don't really understand why it would do something like that.
All right, now I've got to go slow with the details. I'm going to assume your disc cone antenna, 10 feet above all the other hardware, on its own separate mask, is vertically polarized. The signal you're listening to on 584 megacycles, I think you said, is horizontally polarized. So cross-polarization is a factor here. Let me send it back to you to make sure I didn't get that one wrong. Back to you, Joe, with some delay.
Well, yeah, well, I'll tell you what I was doing there. I want to go to the depot bay again. You know, your typical problem you've been having with Channel 3 from, or Channel 33 from Hartford, I actually wanted to take a look at that and actually say, and actually try to measure the differential between New York and Hartford, Connecticut. I was able to actually establish that it's almost the same signal at the point of the antenna in Hartford, or pointed at New York. And that raised a whole other different question. They're about 200 hertz apart, the two carrier frequencies I'm looking at on 584.4.3094. There's definitely discernible pitch, and I used my analyzer off the leaf of the TV antenna, and actually put on the most narrowest trace I could get it, and I could actually see the two pilot carriers, one higher than the other, as they rotated the antenna. But I was looking at the monitor antenna with the R7000 on the same frequency to listen to the audible tone, and that's where I noticed that the actual signal level was varying between an S9 and S5.
Okay. When you listen to what is supposedly a purely horizontally polarized antenna, 584.3894, and you're using a nearly perfectly vertically polarized antenna, cross-polarization can really give you some weird effects. If your instantaneous polarization of your disc cone antenna was absolutely positively purely vertical, and if the signal from Hartford, if that's what 584 was, megacycles, was absolutely purely horizontal, then in theory the signal you pick up would be, let me pick a number, 90 decibels down. And if you tilted your disc cone antenna 1 degree so that it's now at 89 degrees or 91 degrees instead of 90 degrees, instead of being 90 dB down, it'll be 23 dB down, so to speak. Tremendous number of decibels of difference are possible with extremely minor changes in polarization of the receiving antenna or transmitting antenna when true cross-polarization takes place. Now, the world is very complicated in this one. Everything has chirality. When that radio signal comes from Hartford, sifts through all those local trees in your neighborhood, bounces off all the buildings and water towers and everything else in your neighborhood, by the time that signal gets to your particular QTH, is it still purely vertically polarized? On the subject of polarization, I'm going to give you two examples. You've heard them before, but I'm giving other people who are listening to this a little bit of a background on my experience along these lines. Let me drop. First of all, I have a 5/8 wave mag mount vertical rip 2 meters on my station wagon automobile, and this is 1996 time frame. And every single weekend, on Sunday night, I would drive up to Utica, New York, because I was doing some work at the Romeo Development Center. On a Friday night, I would drive back home. In southern New Jersey is K2TXB, Russ Pillsbury, a guy with a 2-meter moon-bounce array, 4 high-power Yagis, 100 feet of tower, a healthy kilowatt of sideband power. He's transmitting that horizontally polarized sideband signal to my automobile as I'm driving north on the New York State Thruway. I told him I'm vertically polarized, he's horizontal. I know we're going to have some trouble. Let's see how far we can get. And to make a long story short, I drive all the way up to Albany, get on Route 90, go drive all the way over to Utica. Behind all of those mountains up there, I'm talking to him all the way, 90% copy sideband. I'm running 180 watts with an amplifier from my automobile, and he's running a kilowatt. I've got a noisier environment because of the local ignition noise of cars going by me, but he's transmitting a whole lot of power. He's in a nice quiet area with good low noise preamp, so my 180 watts got back to him. In other words, even though he's running 8 dB more power than me, because of those differences, we were having about 90% copy in both directions. I eventually put a horizontal square loop antenna mag mount on the car alongside of the whip, with 2 separate cables coming into the car, a switch in the car. I could rapidly, 3 times per second, so to speak, flip back and forth between the horizontal and vertical antenna while I'm driving on the thruway, while I'm talking to Russ K2TXB on subsequent trips, and everything stayed the same. In other words, when I'm on the lowlands of the New York State Thruway and the signal's being sifted through all those trees and buildings and water towers and everything else over that 200-mile path, airline path, between his QTH in southern New Jersey and my automobile traveling at 60 miles an hour on the thruway. Whether I listened to him horizontally or vertically, he sounded the same. Until I got up to a scenic overlook where I had a 30-mile view, and now the horizontal antenna was 15 dB stronger than the vertical. But down in the hinterlands, all of that polarization got completely scattered. That's one piece of information. Where was the second one I was going to give you? I forgot it right now. As you rotate that antenna, whether or not it tilts very slightly, left and right, 1 degree, whether or not that signal getting into your backyard is purely horizontal because of all of the complicated environment between you and Hartford, you've got a very complicated situation there of cross-polarization, and making a signal strength measurement when you've got nearly perfect cross-polarization becomes complicated. This guy Condon, let me drop. The antenna pattern you get, when I use my horizontally polarized Yagi to listen to a ray on top of 100 feet of tower, and I would swing it around and listen to various vertically polarized repeater stations like the one I'm listening to right now, I would see a very complicated pattern. The main lobe is in the right place, side lobes all over the place. Those extra side lobes you get in funny places. Mr. Condon first recognized this when he was writing the Radlab Silver Book number 12, the Radiation Laboratory series of books that came out after World War II, the one entitled Microwave Antennas by Silver. And he has a footnote there describing these lobes. His name is Condon. They became known as Condon lobes. And by the same token, when I listen to this particular repeater in my QTH in Huntington, in my bathroom, I must hold the handy-talkie horizontal, and I get a beautiful signal. If I put my handy-talkie vertical, the 2585 repeater in my bathroom in Huntington drops out. So by the time the signal reflects off my towers and everything else on my property and gets into my bathroom, it's a horizontally polarized signal. So polarization in the real world and environment is complicated. When you do have cross-polarization like you've got, as your rotator rotates and the center of gravity of your lower antennas slightly tilts that pole 1 degree toward or away from Hartford or to the east and to the west at right angles to Hartford, that could, in theory, make a tremendous difference in signal strength, as well as the fact that a little bit of translating could take place. In other words, the pole itself mounted in that rotator is not exactly at the center of rotation. Again, with cross-polarization, extremely minor changes in translation and tilt angle can make a huge difference in signals. I'm not saying this is exactly what you're seeing. All I'm saying, Joe, is these are some of the ingredients of cross-polarization. At times, it seems crazy. I wonder if this sounds at least close to what you're experiencing. From HRYY, with some delay, KQLIW in the SECNET.
Yeah, Dick, also get back to me. I had a funny experience also last week with propagation, so it just reminded me. So when you finish with Joe, come back to me. Over.
I sure will. Joe, you've got it. Leave a little delay.
Okay. You know what? I've never would have given much thought about the polarization effect of what my antenna is to what I was listening to see if that's actually in the numbers. But I was thought like 25 or 30 decibels between horizontal and vertical, but apparently telling me it's much more, like close to 90 decibels between one true polarity to another. It's very interesting. Well, there are other VHF source signals I know coming from different areas than maybe the UHF ones that I know should be truly vertical or close to truly vertical to begin with, and I'll have to try the same experiment again and get back and see what kind of your results end up with those.
Very fine, Joe. Joe, on your very last transmission, you're 10 decibels weaker on the input and quite a bit noisier through the machine. Did you make a change?
Yeah, give the amplifier a chance to cool off. There you go, back to much higher power. Is that better?
Fantastic. Obviously you know about it. I just wanted to make sure you knew that your signal changed a whole lot. Let's go over to Mel's further information on cross-polarization. I'm going to then come back and give you a couple more words, and then we're going to go to your next question. K2KEY. Go right ahead, Mel.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. You remember recently in QSC they had an article about, antenna height, which is better, higher the better. What was always the so-called rule of thumb in amateur radio. Put it up as high as you can. That's the best thing, higher than your mother would like you to see you climbing. But last week, one day, usually when I get home sometime just before dinner, if I have a few minutes, I'll tune around 20 meters CW portion of the band, because by sundown, usually the band is fairly quiet. And I heard a couple of signals on there, and I'm listening, and they seem to be, one signal was a guy out of off an island called Kita. That's an island off the coast of Japan, near the Aleutians, I believe. And then there was another signal I heard very low, a guy from Seoul, Korea. And they were audible to the point that I could copy him, and I could say CW. When I heard the guy in Seoul, Korea, standby call QRZ, I think I give him a call, but all of a sudden I see, everything says, I see on my, what I call the VMU, the data management unit, that you're doing an error. You're doing something incorrect, And I take a quick look and I say, oh boy, no wonder I'm on the wrong antenna here. I'm on my 160-meter antenna. So I flip over to the beam, swing the beam out now, back his way, out towards that part of the world, and I don't even think I could hear him. No, I don't hear him, actually. And how come I'm using a 160-meter antenna, I'm saying? Here I got a beam up much, much higher, and multi-element, and here I got a 160-meter full-length dipole, 280 feet approximately, and I hear him better on that 160-meter antenna than I do I hear him on a 20-meter beam, over.
Okay, when that signal got to you off that ionosphere and got twisted some number of crazy degrees in polarization due to Faraday rotation effects, whether or not it arrived at your house at horizontal, vertical, slant 45 degrees to the right, left, elliptical polarization, in other words, a clockwise ellipse or a counterclockwise ellipse of polarization. By the time it's been through that complicated medium of ionosphere, ocean bounces, your local property, and arrives at your various antennas. And then if we took the true three-dimensional antenna pattern of each one of the antennas you could have used, the 20-meter beam, the loop antenna, and your various ways of feeding a loop antenna, we've got all kinds of patterns. In other words, if I used a horizontal sensing antenna and I swept your 20-meter beam in azimuth, and I made a polar plot, you know what that plot would look like. It'd be a beautiful thing with a nice main lobe and a couple of minor side lobes. If I switched that signal so that it was purely vertically polarized, and I switched and I did a pattern measurement on your 20-meter beam again, you wouldn't recognize it. It would have a null where the bore site of the antenna is supposed to be, where the first null of the pattern normally is. You'll see two side lobes, one to the left and one to the right. You'll have an entirely different pattern, much weaker, but an entirely different pattern when you plot the cross-polarization of that 20-meter Yagi. And if I did the same thing on your loop antenna, if I plotted its three-dimensional pattern in azimuth and elevation, I made an apple plot, as I call it, a three-dimensional antenna plot. And if I used a horizontal sensing antenna, I'll end up with one pattern. A vertical sensing antenna, for the test, I'll give you another pattern. Slant 45 right and left, another pattern. If I then did a elliptical or a circular polarization sensing antenna clockwise, I would see one pattern. Counterclockwise, I'd see another pattern. We all forget about the fact that when we measure our antennas, we think it's a little bit like an amplifier. Let me drop and explain what I mean by that. When I'm testing an amplifier, the manufacturer, let's say it's a advanced receiver research, and the manufacturer told me that if I put 12 volts on this lead, that it's going to have 20 dB of gain, and it's going to have a 0.7 dB noise figure. So this amplifier is sitting on the desk, I'm injecting signals into its input port, I'm measuring signals out of the output port. Controlled condition. I'm giving it voltage, I'm giving it signal, and I see what comes out. And everything inside that box is shielded. It's a controlled environment. Now I decide to take a miniature antenna at a microwave frequency, because I've shrunk it down, and it's sitting on my desk, and I now want to measure that antenna pattern. And I think I'm measuring that antenna. You're measuring the antenna composite with the environment around it. Because by definition, that antenna is emitting a signal all over the place, various amplitudes in three-dimensional space, various polarizations. The signal is bouncing off the desk, it's bouncing off the front panel of the test equipment, and whatever. And so I try to, in that environment, without an anechoic chamber, measure the antenna pattern. Well, if I carefully arrange things just right with some absorbing material around the room, I can measure the bore site gain, and I can get about half a decibel of accuracy out of that. If I try to measure the rest of the pattern, how deep are the nulls between the main lobe and the first side lobe? How strong is the side lobe? How strong are the back lobes? And if I try to make those measurements in my room without it being a high qualified anechoic chamber, what I measure will be very different than the reality. You think you're measuring the antenna, you're measuring the antenna plus the environment. So in the case of that beautiful set of antennas on Dover Street in Manhattan Beach, Brooklyn, where Mel lives, he's got these beautiful antennas, got a nice green wire out in the evergreen tree in the front of the house. He's got this loop antenna with 260 feet of wire. He's got the 20-meter beam. To the human eye, a ham radio operator, a beautiful, pristine set of antennas. To a person with a radio eye, and you're seeing the ground reflection, you're seeing the reflections off the surrounding buildings, the reflections off the towers, the guy wires, and whatever. And that signal gets to him by going through that complicated ionosphere that's twisting the polarization. Which antenna is going to give you the best pattern at each instant of time without making a hell of a lot more measurements and having a hell of a lot more knowledge ain't so easy to predict them. So I'm assuming now that signal arrived quite cross-polarized, like vertical, to your horizontal Yagi. Therefore, it didn't pick up much signal, but the vertical characteristics of your other antenna was significantly better. That's a pure guess on my part. Back to you, Mel, for rebuttal, if you like. K2KEY with some delay. Like your more audio. K2LIW.
Okay. This is K2KEY. Well, what happened after that? I couldn't get... maybe if I started fooling with a tuner and all, maybe I could get the 160-meter antenna to load on 20. But what I did, I said, give him a shot with the beam. I'll call him, give him a call on the beam. And sure enough, I flip back to the 160-meter antenna, and he comes back to me. Okay. I go back to him, I flip back to the beam, and we exchange you know, general QSO name, 68, signal report. Then he comes back to me, he gives me his rig and everything using a six-element beam and on a 25-meter tower, a whole business, you know. And when I come back to him, I tell him what I'm using and all, and I says, transmitting, you know, to you on a four-element beam on 23-meter tower and receiving you on a 160-meter dipole. He comes back to me. He says, well, I'm receiving you on a beverage antenna. I cannot hear you. He also, no copy on the beam, but he's copying me on a beverage antenna, Dick. So it seems like some kind of crazy situation developing here that we couldn't go beam to beam, but we could go beam to dipole or beam to beverage, Dick, over.
That doesn't surprise me, Mel, because Faraday rotation is the one kind of propagating medium that does not obey reciprocity. That's just one of the peculiar characteristics of what's called gyrotropy, if you really like the fancy words for it. And this also is true of what happens inside of a circulator. A circulator is a magnetic, is a microwave device that's got three ports. You put a signal into port one, and a signal will come out of port two. In port three, you put a termination on it. Put a signal into port two, expecting it to come out of port one, it doesn't. It goes to port three and goes into the termination. That's where the isolation comes from with a circulator. It's a fancy piece of ferrite material with a local magnetic field. Okay, that ionosphere is a fancy plasma material, a conducting medium that has dielectric characteristics with the Earth's magnetic field mixing into it. Therefore, the signal that comes out of your horizontally polarized Yagi goes over to, let's assume the guy was in London. The guy's in London, and it arrives vertically polarized. His beverage antenna he's receiving you on is primarily a vertically polarized antenna, and you sound good on his beverage. But because it arrives vertically polarized, his horizontal six-element Yagi on 75 feet of tower, I think it's at 25 meters up, 75 feet of tower, doesn't receive you. Correspondingly, when he sends back the signal to you on his horizontal Yagi, just by coincidence, arrives somewhat vertical in your neighborhood, is my guess. And therefore, you picked him up on your other antenna. The horizontal Yagi didn't pick him up well. So it's a combination of cross-polarization, lack of reciprocity. RF propagation is strange stuff. There are people who have spent a good lifetime studying it and all of the crazy characteristics in the real world of various environments, and it doesn't always follow common sense unless you've got quite a bit more knowledge of what the medium is like and what the antenna patterns are like. So, although it's kind of crazy, beam to beam, you didn't make it. Beam to beverage, beautiful. And beam to dipole, beautiful. Now, you call it a dipole, 180 meter dipole, but I'm not sure that your property is big enough to spread out the dipole in the normal manner. You're calling it a dipole. Isn't it really a loop, or isn't it zigzag in various ways? Give me a couple of words on that one, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
No. This is a full spread out classic dipole, Dick. In fact, it's super classic. It looks so perfect. It's, I just drew it on a piece of paper, you know, how a dipole always appears. We always say, well, you can droop it, you can, you know, twist it. No, this is a nice 135 feet north and 135 feet south. Set right in the middle in how I did this. This was really a feat, as they say. The number of, first of all, let me put it this way. A number of the DX, you know, professional, I call them professional DXs, seem to favor for receiving, in many cases, beverage antennas. Now, I don't know if they you know, really are attracted to beverage antennas with a higher frequency, such as maybe 20 meters up. But you, I've heard many of them say that the beverage antenna really performs fantastically well, say somewhere between 1.5 megahertz and maybe about 10 megahertz, Dick. So I've heard this a number of times about the performance of a beverage antenna that is, you know, many wavelengths, long, many of them are really long wires. One guy I remember speaking to in Florida, he was telling me his beverage was somewhere around 1,600 or 1,700 feet long and terminated at some far end. So maybe there's something to this beverage, especially if you keep it close to the ground, that it does do something more than, you know, than maybe a dipole or a beam can perform, Dick, over.
Without a doubt. Beverage and Rhombic are two of the main particular antennas that are part of the subset called traveling wave antennas, as opposed to a standing wave antenna. A simple half-wave dipole is a standing wave antenna. The energy you put into it, the charge, it's really a glob of electrons, but it's the charge you put onto the antenna in the center, usually, bounces back and forth a whole lot of times, like 20, before the majority of energy gets radiated into space. In the case of a rhombic or a beverage, the signal travels down that wire, when you're transmitting, travels down that wire once and hits the 600 ohm usual termination at the far end. And what gets radiated in the leaky wave structure along that length. The good news about a beverage is that it's got a significant amount of gain, primarily in one direction. It's primarily vertically polarized. So it's a high gain antenna, and the only major disadvantage is it's an inexpensive antenna. It's a simple piece of wire suspended above the ground, parallel to the ground. Both Rhombic and beverage in their pure form look like that. So the raw materials are not very expensive, and it's capable of having a lot of gain, but you better have an awful lot of property or access to a lot of property in order to set them up. You're not going to set up a 160-meter beverage antenna on 1 acre of property, so to speak. It ain't big enough. You'd like to have a 3, 4, 5, 10, 15, 20 wavelengths of wire if you can do it, if you've got the real estate to do it, and it really takes real estate. Another factor that's going on here is that a receiver is amazingly forgiving. You can have a receiving antenna with a 40-to-1 standing wave ratio, and your S meter won't deflect quite as far on the receiver. If it was previously an S9 signal, and you do something to the antenna where you don't change its gain, but you just change its impedance match, and now it's a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio into your receiver, instead of reading S9, it'll read S7.5. But the signal-to-noise ratio will stay roughly the same. A receiver is amazingly forgiving. You try to transmit back into that antenna with a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio, and most likely a transmitter will give you quite a bit of grief. It doesn't like a 20-to-1 standing wave ratio. Transmitters are kind of persnickety. Modern-day, no-tune transmitters. The old-fashioned days, when we had a real massive pi-tuning network in the final stage. Let me drop. Where our transmitters had a real tuning and loading capacitor, a real wide-range pi network in the transmitter. Now you could load anything from 5 ohms to 500 ohms, and that's at least a 10-to-1 standing wave ratio, if you know what I mean, and a whole lot of other reactive impedances in between. So the one experiment you guys didn't do is to transmit, in your case, into your 160-meter dipole while he listened on both Yagi and Beverage, and conversely, if he transmitted into the Beverage and you listened on your two antennas or three or four antennas you got on the property, even that vertically polarized 40-meter green piece of wire in the front yard would have been a fun experiment in this case. You got to go back to that guy, Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. Well, you know, transmitting into a terminated beverage down at the end, when putting any kind of considerable power in, you'll most likely fry the terminating resistors at the end or whatever. I've never heard anybody on the air that transmitted into a beverage, to tell you the truth. They have used them, like I say, extensively as receiving antennas, but I've never seen, you know, any application or any kind of, you know, any kind of information about using a beverage as a transmitting antenna. I guess because of the antenna being basically maybe because you may not be able to load it so easily. Even with the older rigs, even with antenna tuners, you may have a problem there. Of course. Yeah, I guess if I fooled around with a tuner or something like that, I could most likely maybe get the 160-meter antenna to load fairly well on 20, but that would have been a whole project. I mean, we couldn't just, you know, it was just 10-minute QSO or whatever, an 8-minute QSO, and that's it. You know, you jam it in real fast because I'm sure there are other people wanting to work them, basically. So anyhow, you know, you can't really tie up DX stations. In fact, seldom do they really have any really QSO other than maybe a minute or two. So I was very surprised to, you know, really get this much info out of them. But as far as, I could say, a beverage being only, in many cases, I hear, gee, like 10 feet of ground, and most of these guys, I've heard the description, they'll put them only like 10 feet, just enough to be able to safely walk under it, Dick, and like you say, many wavelengths along over.
Yeah, I don't think the beverage has to be very high to work well. In order to have a continuous characteristic, simple pattern, and constant impedance along its length, you would like the height of the wire along the length to be the same. In other words, you don't want to start off with it 5 feet above the ground at one end and 50 feet above the ground at the other end in its pure form. You might want to do that as a further experiment. It isn't going to suddenly explode and stop working because you've done that. But now it's a modified beverage with a tapered impedance, and that's got an entirely different characteristic. Now, if the guy has enough property to make the beverage antenna a good number of wavelengths long, 5, 10, 15 wavelengths long, because of the way the beverage works on transmit, I'm going to guess 85% of the power is radiated before it gets to the terminating resistor. So even if you're running a full 1,000 watts, maybe only 150 watts gets to the terminating resistor. And also, he has the technology to build a 600-ohm terminating resistor that could take 1,000 watts. So that's not a gating item. I think guys have not transmitted into a beverage for traditional reasons and reasons of passing old wives' tales back and forth to each other. I guarantee that if you transmit into a beverage and the people at Mackay Radio in Brentwood, Long Island, did run rhombics and beverages that they transmitted into. So did RCA at Wireless Road or whatever it is. I'm trying to think of the name of the road out there in Middle Island where RCA Laboratories was located. They also had beverage and rhombic-like antennas. They transmitted 10,000 watts into them. So the fact that the modern-day ham has passed information back and forth among his ham radio buddies saying it's only a receiving antenna, does that mean it's going to suddenly explode if you transmit into it? Try it. You'll like it. Now, how many feet or wavelengths long was the beverage of the guy you talked to? Was he in England? I missed that. Was he in England? And are you sure he wouldn't be willing to transmit back to you, Mel? And with a little bit of experimenting, you can find a way of loading up your 160-meter dipole on 20 meters. Let me think about that now. Second harmonic of 160 is 80. Fourth harmonic would be 20. Fourth harmonic. It would be a difficult load. You're probably going to see an impedance of something like 500 or 1,000 ohms. But you're the guy that's got the wherewithal to readjust your antenna tuner that can tolerate that. So how long was the beverage, and do you think you're going to talk him into transmitting to you on his beverage? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Now, this is K2KEY. Well, like I say, with a DX station and one that's...
Well...
Well, I